who is in need of a copy of Ashendi? I don't think everybody is. I don't think everybody is, but some of you are, yes. There we are. You got one, Tony? One, two, yeah. Okay. Anybody else? Okay. There's still a few copies. I've still got one, two, three, four. Anybody else? It's tough reading, but by golly, once you've got the idea, once you've grasped the insanity, then the rest follows like clockwork, as you'll see. So we're looking at section 7. let me use a stick, which will help, I think. So he says, what is faith? Faith, then, notice the quotation marks. We're at the bottom of 7, just before 7b. The end of the positive principles. Faith is an inner sense coming from the heart, coming from the need of the divine in the subconsciousness. So it's my heart and my intelligence, it's the fire engine inside, yeah? It's just my needs, and it's comes from underneath, and underneath my mind, underneath my heart. It's just inside me. It's a feeling inside. It's what Ronald Knox used to call a nif, a nice internal feeling. And it's, you know, the modernism is, the new religion is the nif religion. And when I no longer have a nif, you know, then I have a sniff, because I'm disappointed. So everything in function of nice internal feelings. Faith is an inner sense coming from the need of the divine in the subconscious. So it comes and connected, we said, with the heart. Excited by the unknowable beyond the phenomena. So here are the phenomena of the Galilean, which for some reason are quite exciting phenomena. I mean, what was special about the Galilean is that his phenomena were in some way exciting. So, I am excited by these phenomena, but I don't know what's the other side of them. But since these phenomena excite me, then onto these phenomena, I project from inside what my subconscious needs. So, whereas revelation in Aristotle... revelation in Aristotle is his, if he will forgive me, the Galilean, so to speak. And for Aristotle, that's Aristotle. Not that Aristotle was ever exposed to Christian revelation, but nevertheless. So, in reality, this is the man-god, and the man-god imposes on my intelligence that he is the man-god. So his being the man-god comes from the object to the subject. With Kant, it's exactly the reverse. With Kant, hold on. Here are the phenomena of the Galilean. And here is Frankenstein. With Kant, it's the internal feeling coming up from the heart which goes into my subconscious, and that needs a man-god. So the man-god comes from inside and then gets projected onto the outside so that the phenomena get covered with man-godness, splattered from the vomitings of my heart. Can you imagine anything more blasphemous? Anything almost literally more sickening? But that's exact. This is modernism. This is... So, excited by the unknowable beyond the phenomena, because the Galilean phenomena are somehow especially exciting, this sense produces the man-god that it then believes in. So the object of my belief comes from inside me and gets projected onto the phenomena. Because there's no way in which my mind can know any reality beyond the phenomena. Therefore, there's no question of the man God behind the appearance of the Galilean imposing on my mind, "Thou art Christ, the Son of the living God." No question. But it's Peter's need which threw up from his gut, "Thou art the Christ," and then Peter splattered it all over Jesus of Nazareth. So that's faith. So you can see why we put it in inverted commas. Because this new faith is totally different from the real faith. Totally different. But they call it faith. It's still called, they use the old words, but the substance is completely changed. What then is revelation? A point comes where you can do all of this by yourself. Once you've got the principle. So here is the old meaning of revelation is that Jesus Christ revealed the Son of God, and I then knew I accepted by faith what the evidence was telling me, that this was the man of God. So the revelation comes from the object to the subject. Well, again, revelation in this case is when I splatter the phenomena with my vomit, the vomit then revealed to me my God. The vomit splattered over the phenomena, revealed to me my God. So this is revelation. So revelation is the subconscious need splattering the phenomena and then realizing what it believes in.
No two persons God to be the same.
Sorry?
No two persons God to be the same.
No two persons?
My God and your God would have to be different.
Yes. Yes. Only the modernist admits that these phenomena of the Galilean are especially exciting in some way. These phenomena, they got vibes. We got vibes, man. These phenomena have got vibes, and you know, they have a trick of making your gut vomit and of making the same phenomena make my gut vomit, and therefore we agree in thinking that the Galilean is God, right? But of course, what my vomit splattered over the phenomena is not the same as your vomit splattered over the phenomena. All that's common is that the same phenomena projected your splattering and my splattering. Therefore, in that sense, your God is different from my God. Yes, we each of us have a completely individual concept of the man God. You know, these are horrors to make anyone, you know, I mean, absolutely plug his ears. But the modern world is full of these horrors. We have a sup full of horrors, Jim.
You used an interesting pyramid about the conception of a man God. Does that formula then preclude the possibility of apprehending a God man?
A God man would be the same thing, I guess. I mean, I man, God, or God, man. I mean, I don't know God. God is, in any case, only what I project. I mean, the man is phenomena.
I was thinking a man, God, you'd be looking as it were from the horizontal level and to the vertical, whereas the other way you'd be.
But I have no way of knowing any real God who's out there, because in any case, he's not phenomena. All that I know out there is phenomena. The rest comes from inside me. So with the man, God, I start from the phenomena of the Galilean, from the man. And I slatted him, and then he becomes a man God. Right? So that's right. In this sense, God is manifested or revealed. So by this process, God is revealed. I mean, he becomes IHS from my vomiting. Actually, it's not inside. I mustn't pretend that it's inside. It's actually outside. So it's IHS. That's how he turns into the God. And this is the revelation, IHS, this is the revelation of God. So this is what revelation means. Again, the same word, totally different meaning. Here revelation is the reality of the divinity inside this humanity, revealing itself with grace, revealing itself to my faith, to my intellect with faith. Thou art the Son, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Peter makes an act of faith, but his intelligence has been given easily enough evidence by our Lord. It's not an arbitrary act of faith, it's a completely justified act of faith. And Peter knows that this is God, there is God inside this man. That's so the revelation goes from the object to the subject, but here the revelation goes from the subject to the object. Therefore the word revelation has been completely stood on its head, but still they use the same word. Next one, supernatural. So in this sense God is manifested or revealed, therefore revelation is the inner sense, this is revelation, splattering the phenomena and showing to me what it is that I believe. God revealing himself to the soul. So this is God revealing himself to the soul from which he came. So this is just basically a process of self-knowledge. But it's all me. It all comes from inside me and it's coming back to me. The phenomena are simply the bounce, the place to bounce my vomit. That's all it is really. They're a vibrator which provoke my gut to bounce my vomit back to me, and that's revelation coming from the phenomena back to me, and that's faith, me believing in these phenomena as God.
If you believe this and were teaching in Noble's Harbor Seminary,
yes.
What word would you use instead of vomit?
Yes, I understand perfectly. Good question. I think experience is the buzzword.
Experience.
This is my experience of the divinity. This is my experience of the Godhead. I was at the charismatic meeting last night, and I had a real experience. Right? I think that's the buzzword they use. We'll see it used again and again, right? So that's a word they love. Then, next, the supernatural. Now, revelation is supernatural because this is the supernatural God, and Peter makes a supernatural act of faith. Because like doubting Thomas makes a supernatural act of faith. Thomas's hand tells him the natural truth that there's a hole here in the human being. That's entirely natural. And Thomas's faith is given back to him and he makes an act of faith, my Lord and my God. So this is supernatural. Thou art the Son of the living Christ is supernatural. So then, this is supernatural. So what is supernatural? Supernatural is the natural getting to know itself. The supernatural consciousness is revelation, and the supernatural is natural. So this completely natural process coming up from my gut, splattering over the phenomena, and reflecting back to my mind, this is all a completely natural process, but now this is the same as what used to be called supernatural, therefore the supernatural is natural. And so modernism is swimming in naturalism. Of course it is. We've completely wiped God out, and everything in Catholicism is to be explained in purely human terms. So, the supernatural is natural, because attracted by the unknowable, beyond the phenomena, the religious sense kicks in with its needs, projects upon the phenomena the divinity or God that it needs, and by so doing, it transforms the phenomena from being a mere man into being God. And therefore, faith, quote unquote, transfigures the phenomena and also disfigures the phenomena. It disfigures the phenomena because the phenomena out there have nothing divine about them. Or anything divine beyond the phenomena is completely unknowable. Back to over here. The Ding An Sich is completely unknowable. But by projecting, by my faith, quote unquote, which is this process, projecting upon the phenomena of the Godhead, I completely transform the phenomena. But of course the phenomena are not God at all, therefore I'm also disfiguring the phenomena. But that's just all part of the process. So attracted by the unknowable beyond faith, quote unquote, transfigures and disfigures the phenomena. Therefore, all religions come from the inner sense, not only Catholicism, but any religion at all comes from this same process. And all supernature, quote unquote, or everything that everybody, all the Catholics used to call supernature, is all completely from inside, in other words, nature. Therefore, there's no such thing as the supernatural. And the quote-unquote supernatural is simply my nature projecting my needs upon natural phenomena where they don't really belong. But since I need them, that's okay. In other words, there's not a grain of truth in my quote-unquote faith, but my quote-unquote faith is what I need. Follow? Absolutely. Absolutely. Therefore, all religions are as good as one another. As long as they all just project inner needs and satisfy inner needs, that's fine. And that's why modernists are ecumenical. That's why John Paul II is ecumenical. He can't see any real difference between Catholicism. Catholicism, the phenomena of Catholicism, like a little white host, like a nicely decorated chapel, like some statues, those phenomena are simply more skillful and more successful in getting the religious sense vibrating until it... And so more people have vomited over the Catholic phenomena than they've vomited over other phenomena, and therefore the Catholic religion is a higher grade religion insofar as it's a better vomit maker. It's horrific. I mean, it's enough to make your hair stand on end. But as you may remember, back to 4, these characters are all audacious. They stop at nothing. They stop at nothing. They will declare anything. Therefore, all religions come from the inner sense, and all supernatural issues from nature. Now, what happens to dogma in this system? Dogma, we saw this morning, we saw up here. Dogma is a truth which has been defined. Now, the divinity of our Lord Jesus Christ, it was very rapid. The Catholic Church rested upon the divinity of our Lord Jesus Christ, proved by the resurrection, amongst other proofs. And therefore, the Catholic Church defined that the man Jesus Christ was/is God. That's dogma. Now, what happens to dogma down here? Just think. The mind expresses this sense in a primitive formula. I'll give you an example. This is one of my favorites. So you see, here I am in front of the phenomenon of the Galilean. Maybe it's a nice statue of the Sacred Heart, so, because the Galilean is not around. So I sit there and I vibrate and I say, "Jeez," to express my experience. And then I say, I'm still sitting there, and I continue to vibrate, and I say, "God." And then I formulate that expression. I formulate my experience, my vibration, my vomit. I put it into a proposition. "Jeez equals God." So we've got... So, when I'm vibration one, "Geez." Vibration two, "God." I hope I shall be forgiven these things, but yeah, I'm caricaturing, obviously. But "Geez, God." And then that evolves into the dogma. I express that as a dogma. "Geez is God." Jesus is God. So it all began as vibrations, and then it turns into a proposition. "Jesus is God," and that turns into "Jesus is God." Huh? It's simply the piling up of vibrations. Vibrations and vomit. So vibrations and vomit put into a proposition make a dogma. The mind expresses this sense in primitive formulae. To begin with, it's very primitive. It's just an exclamation, "Oh, geez." And then it's another exclamation, "God," G-A-W-D. And then I put the two together in a proposition, and I make "geez equals God," which is "Jesus is God." And so I have worked up my primitive vibrations into a formula, "Jesus is God." And that is a dogma. Therefore, it follows that dogmas are secondary. Dogmas are merely the expression of my beautiful internal feelings, of my nice internal feelings. So if my nice internal feelings change, and I stand in front of G's and I say, ugh, or yuck, then what happens to the dogma, G's is good? It's changed into Jesus equals yuck. But what happens to the dogma, Jesus is good? Forget it, it's gone. In other words, in modernism, the dogmas follow the internal feelings. And if the internal feelings change, then the dogmas must change. Now, I stand in the church, and I recite consubstantial with the Father. That no longer makes me feel anything. So, out of the window. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ. That made me vibrate 10 years ago, but it no longer makes me vibrate. So, out of the window. So, as to the object, they're merely inadequate symbols. Because if I say Jesus is God or Jesus is God, that is absolutely inadequate to express my wonderful feeling as I stand in front of the Galilean, at any rate on last Thursday. So, even Jesus is God is inadequate to express my wonderful feeling. And secondly, as to the subject, they are mere instruments. Jesus is God is simply something that helps me to get to know my wonderful feelings. So the dogma is entirely subservient to my feelings. It's inadequate to express them. And It's only a means of expressing them. So if my nice internal feelings change, then Jesus is God may well go out the window. And Jesus is yuck may well better express what I really feel and experience. So instead of Jesus is God, we're going to have Jesus is yuck.
Can truth be changed?
Of course. Absolutely. Truth is evolving all the time. Absolutely. Therefore, dogmas must adapt to the sense, we're into 13, that dogmas, Jesus God, follows the heart, the internal religious sense. And if the religious internal sense no longer vibrates to Jesus God, then the dogma will change. And the dogmas must adapt to the believer using them. Now, we're living in the 20th century, so all of these 3rd century, 5th century, 8th century, 13th century definitions, just if they no longer correspond to our vibrations, well then out with the Nicene Creed and the Athanasian Creed and with the definitions of the councils, and in with the guitars, because the guitars, and we don't need no education, that corresponds to what I feel. So religion is going to turn into, we don't need no education. We don't need no thought control, and so on and so on. Right? Therefore, dogmas must adapt to the sense and to the believer using them. Otherwise, they're not vital or living. There's a buzzword of the modernists. So, in answer to your question, they wouldn't talk about a vomit. They would talk about a living experience. A living experience. And they might well throw in also a transcendental. A transcendental living experience.
Father's Day, 1970, and at the procession or the communion, I forget which, they played that Silver-Haired Daddy of Mine. Now I think I know why.
Yes, that's right. Yes, to project God as a silver-haired daddy makes me feel good.
Yeah, and especially on Father's Day.
Yes, that's right. Conclusion, dogmas must evolve. Because the religious sense is living, the religious sense evolves. I was 29, 39, 49, 50, I'm evolving all the time. Therefore the dogmas must evolve in order to be a successful expression and instrument of my evolving religious sense. So we're now in the 20th century. So that's why when Father Courtney Murray gets back to Fordham University, he's already out of date. When Courtney Murray gets back to Fordham, he's no longer expressing the wonderful vibrations on Fordham University. Their vibrations have moved on. Therefore, the whole Catholic religion is going to change every 3 or 4 or 5 months, or days, or hours. You got it. Phew, you got it. It's mind-boggling. But this is what these people... Again, if I express it like this, it's an absolute caricature, and you can see it clearly. Just like if I say that a Kantian ought to walk into the wall, you can see clearly how crazy it is. But Kantians don't usually walk through the wall. They usually walk through the door. Because they've got enough common sense to realize that if they don't think that the black liquid is coffee, they're going to get very thirsty. Therefore, their system is selective. Similarly, the modernist system is selective. They turn this on and turn it off as they like. And therefore, they're perfectly capable of resting upon the religious sense quite a lot of correct statements. But the correct statements resting upon their religious sense are totally different from the same statements resting upon objective truth. Totally different, obviously. Therefore, when these modernists tell a truth, it's very worrying. Because they might deceive people into thinking that they're Catholics. And they may tell 9 truths in a row, and then you get the banana skin of the 10th. And the poor and this is what has to happen to the poor Catholics in relation to Rome all the time. Rome keeps putting out these 9 truths one after another, and the dear Catholics say, Rome is Rome once more. Ah, we've got a Pope that we can trust. Ah, I always thought Cardinal Ratzinger was a good guy. And then comes the banana skin, and then the poor Catholics are sort of, they're flat on their back with the banana skin. If they get up on their feet again by the grace of God, they repeat the experience. These poor modernists have lost it. And there's nothing to be done with them except pray for them, love them, pray for them. But there's nothing else to be done with them. There's no way in which people thinking like this can save the church. And there's no way in which people thinking like this can look after tradition. They can provide a Tridentine Mass with all the frills and furbelows in New York Cathedral, but that's not a hope for the church. It helps in its way because it puts some of the right phenomena back in front of a lot of Catholics. But it's no use in the long run. It's no real use because it's all resting upon the religious sense. The cardinals, Cardinal Stickler, Cardinal Ratzinger, and Cardinal O'Connor are getting together and they're saying, let's give these poor people what makes them feel good. And a Tridentine Mass with all the frills and furbelows, a pontifical high solemn Tridentine Mass, makes them feel good, so let's give it to them. Not because this is what God commands or this is what will save their souls, but because this is what will make them feel good. You can't save the church on that basis. No way. Except by the fact that since they did what always used to be done, then some poor dear Catholics did get an eyeful, an earful of what it should be like. But every time one of those cardinals gets up in the pulpit, be careful. You may even hear 9 truths in a row, but be careful of that 10th, because you never know when it's going to be a banana skin. How do I know that number 5 wasn't banana skin? It sounded okay. And number 9 sounded okay. And even all 10 sounded okay. Maybe Cardinal Stickler gave a completely orthodox sermon. But what's he going to do next week or the week? How do I know? If he's resting it all upon religious sense and not upon objective truth. You can't trust these dear guys. And we don't, you know, I say they're dear guys. There's no question of saying they're all criminals or horrible. Well, Don Putti said, objectively, sono tutti delinquenti. Objectively, they're all delinquents. Subjectively, they're really nice guys. They mean well. That's not a problem. They have good faith, they have good intentions, they're sincere, they mean well, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But they've lost it. However well they mean, they've lost it. And the salvation of the church cannot come through them any more than the salvation of our Lord could come through Caiaphas. It's just, they've lost it. They've lost it. So, unless one of them converts, but if one of them converts, what happens to him? He's out. He's out. He can't survive in that Rome.
What are the indult priests playing a dual role here? As per Cardinal
The indult priests surely often have the faith. Surely often they have the faith. But they are believing, but They are believing that the faith is such a thing as can be protected by these people in Rome. Or put it another way round, they are believing that the people in Rome are capable of protecting the real faith. That's a big mistake. Therefore, either their understanding of the real faith is a little off, or their understanding of who the people are in Rome is a little off. But it comes back to the same thing. Their understanding of the faith is not completely on. If they put themselves... I mean, any chicken that puts himself under the care of a fox doesn't quite understand how chickens are built and or how foxes are built. I mean, any chicken that puts himself under a fox has got a problem. These indulters, you know, all those committing indultery are, you know, in grave danger of finding that the fox suddenly, you know, just chops the head off. Back a little while ago, Monsignor Pearl, about 2 years ago in Germany, said that the indult was not going to last beyond 1999. He gave it away, apparently. I mean, I can't give you chapter and verse for that, the document, but he said, and it's been said again more recently. They do say, occasionally these characters give themselves away and they make it clear that they don't mean to protect or guarantee tradition. They're just stringing tradition along until eventually the traditionalists get wise and abandon tradition and join the mainstream church. I mean, the documents are there to show that that is what Rome is actually thinking. That's an example. Edward Cassidy writing to some Irish Catholic. Yep.
Now, suppose we get a traditionalist pope of America.
Yes.
Could he change things around?
Very good question.
Does he command the hearts of all the people who are in the hierarchy?
Very good question. Supposing by miracle we had a traditional pope, what could he do? He, in a sense, he couldn't... Well, maybe John Paul I was just beginning to be traditional, and that's why, you know, they got in. They got to him before he could get to them. They got in there first because they watch like a hawk. And it's God's punishment that the Vatican is now so under the control of the enemy that there's no hope for a traditional pope or even a semi-traditional pope inside Rome today. The enemy have taken hundreds of years to get control of Rome and they're not about to roll over and play dead. Therefore, if we had a traditional pope, what Pius X had a vision of was the pope fleeing Rome over the body of his priests with two cardinals. The Pope fleeing from Rome over the bodies of his priests with two cardinals. He had a vision of it. Pius X, I think.
Ratzinger wasn't one of them.
So if this Pope converts, he will have to run for his life. And there are prophecies about the Pope running from Rome and dying in exile. A broken man, a very upset and broken man. I think there are prophecies about that. So your answer to your question is you're quite right. Rome is in the hands of the enemy. It's completely in the hands of the enemy. The Pope would have to run for it if he suddenly, by the grace of God, which is always possible, converted and understood. He'd have to run. And then the others would, of course, track him down. They'd do their best to track him down. But God is God and, you know. Let's move on. We move on to the believer. So that's the philosophy of the situation. Now we bring in belief, because of course all of this is purely natural. Well, what does belief? Belief. He's already discussed faith actually in 7b, and belief is not very different. 14a. But we've got an interesting definition: the divine is knowable as reality by a suprarational experience. This experience or religious sense is what makes the believer. We're back to this diagram. The divine, in other words, Jesus is God, is knowable as a reality by a supra-rational, or we might better say sub-rational. It's above the reason or else beneath it. An experience, in any case, an experience which doesn't come from reason. It's beyond reason. It transcends reason. I just have this feeling that Jesus is God. Or that the man Maitreya is God, or that I have this feeling that John Paul II is the most wonderful pope we've ever had. You know, I can't explain it, I can't give reasons, it's transcendental. So, The divine is knowable by this supra-rational experience, and this experience or religious sense is what makes the believer. I mean, Frankenstein here believes that Jesus is God because his religious sense has projected divinity upon the phenomena of the Galilean. Right? So this, the religious sense is what makes the believer. Consequences, that's the principle. Frankenstein is a believer by his religious sense. Application. Therefore, immediately, ecumenism is true. All religions in which there is any religious sense are equally valid. If I splatter my vomit over the Galilean, that's valid. If I splatter my vomit over the Buddha because he makes me vibrate better, that's valid. If I splatter my vomit, etc., etc. Any religion which makes me feel good is valid. Because feeling good is what religion is about. Therefore, what's tradition? You can have fun trying to work these things out for yourself now on the basis of these principles. What does tradition become in this system? Tradition is you might say, like a lava flow of solidified vomit down the ages, right? I mean, a lot of people have vomited over the Galilean, and there's therefore like a pile of vomit to and from the Galilean, and that pile of vomit all flowing down the same channel is tradition. It's the build-up over the over age. What does he say? Let's have a look. Tradition is merely the original experience. Well, it's not quite what he says. It's the original experience so transmitted as to stimulate or awaken the religious sense. In other words, what he's saying there is this. Tradition is the... Jesus is God is part of tradition. Because that was an expression of what I felt about the Galilean, which others also feel about the Galilean. And so my successful expression got handed down, and when it got handed down to generation after generation, it turned into tradition. So the best splatterings, the most successful splatterings, solidify into tradition. So I was about right. Tradition is a sort of lava flow, a solidified lava flow of successful splatterings. It's the original experience transmitted in such a way as to stimulate or awaken the religious sense. I mean, the apostles talked about the Galilean in such a way that the next generation after the apostles also vibrated in the same way and also projected their vomit on the Galilean. And then the generation after that, so whoever finds a really good formula to express internal feelings is going to make a tradition. What about faith and science? What about the problem of faith and science? Well, the faith and science is no longer a problem, but for the following reason. That science, now science is serious, we all know that. Science deals with the phenomena. Science sticks to the phenomena. And the phenomena are real, and science deals in realities. I see the little bubbles dancing up and down in the test tube. Now that's serious. I put on a white coat, I put on spectacles, and I go on TV, and I say, look, folks, the bubbles are going up and down the test tubes. Now that's real. Okay, so that's science. So science is on this side of the phenomena, and it's all completely true. That's verifiable, it's testable, it's etc., etc. Faith is all what we pretend is on the other side of the phenomena. I mean, I splatter this on the phenomena so that I then pretend that it's inside the phenomena. Right? So faith is on the other side of the phenomena. Science is on this side of the phenomena. Therefore, there can't be a clash between the two of them. Science is serious. Faith is just fiction, transfiguring and disfiguring fiction. Therefore, there's no problem between science and faith. So we've solved, just like that, the age-old problem of science and faith. Pretty easy. However, what's the relationship between faith and science? He says that faith is subordinate. And you've got a very brief summary there, which we can't go into now. But whereas in Catholicism, science is subordinate to faith, in modernism, the two are firstly split apart. And then insofar as they have to come together, faith is subordinate to science. Faith, science used to be subordinate to faith. Now they're wrenched apart. And then faith is put under science. Because, of course, modern man worships science. Because he's a materialist. So the materialistic science is a truth. And the rest is more or less Reader's Digest stuff. So there's serious thinking and then there's Reader's Digest nicey-nicey thinking. Faith is the nicey-nicey stuff and science is serious. Right? How many people think that today, for goodness sakes? And how many people that go to the Tridentine Mass on Sunday still have a nicey-nicey Sound of Music idea of what Catholicism really means? Catholicism is the nicey-nicey stuff for Sunday morning, but serious thinking is Monday to Friday. Saturday is for the kids. Sunday morning is the nicey-nicey stuff. Sunday afternoon is trying to keep the wife happy. And then Monday we get back to serious business. Such is life, right? All religions... So there's a comment from Gregory the Ninth. A very interesting paragraph 18, ring paragraph 18, and then make sure you read it. With modernists, one page is Catholic, the next page is rationalist, and so on. On their system, the modernist is perfectly capable of saying completely orthodox things, but they rest upon a quite different basis. The modernist is perfectly capable of saying that Jesus is God. But that, all of that is a successful explanation of his nice feelings. A very good formula to express his nice feelings. But if his nice feelings were to change, there's no question of Jesus really objectively out there being God. All of that's completely unknowable. So Jesus could just as well be God as not be God. It depends upon my feelings. We move on to the theologian. Again, this is very, very condensed. Paragraph 19, I think it's quite important. And we start with the principles of the modernist theologian, which are the faith, quote-unquote, the transformation of the faith. Then we have the application from 21 to 25, and we get the new understanding, the modernist understanding of dogma once more. We had it back under the philosopher, 11, 12, 13. Now we've got dogma again, 21. We get the modernist understanding of the sacraments. We get the modernist understanding of scripture, and we get the modernist understanding of what the church is. And they're all completely transformed, as you might guess, from the Catholic idea of what they are. And then another very interesting, a third section, instead of just principles and application, we've got a third section under theologian, which is the development. And that's very interesting. The development by evolution and by dialectic. Very, very interesting. Let's have a look firstly at the principles of the theologian. Now this is horribly condensed. This is packed, packed, packed. And what Pius X argues is that the combination of the philosopher and the believer, we get the theologian takes part of his thing from the philosopher, then part of his thing from the believer. Those are the two sections we dealt with. And the combination of the philosopher and the believer makes the propositions of the theologian. So for instance, the philosopher says that the principle of faith, the pie of faith, meaning the principle of faith, the origin of faith is inside me. So the philosopher says, this was section one, the origin of the faith is inside. The believer says that the origin of faith is God, and so the theologian concludes that God is inside. So God is inside us. You see sick, Jim?
Yes, well, sir. It's just as hard to believe that rational people can be so...
Do you know when we go so back to seminary? The old Shannon Bethel, he was a member of the... he wasn't all that old, actually. But he was a member of the canons of the Great St. Bernard. You know, the big dogs with brandy under their neck in the Swiss pass. Well, that's them. They used to have a kind of sort of toothpaste white cord around their... you know, those are the Shannon. He was one of those. He said that when the encyclical came out, if the modernists wanted to explain their system to an apprentice of modernism, do you know what they did? Go and read Pashendi. If you want to understand our system, go and read Pashendi. That's how good the Catholic theologians were at nailing down and organizing what these characters actually think. But if you're proud, and if you want to appear like a Catholic, but dance with the fairies, this is the way to do it. And that's the appeal. You're too sane, by the grace of God, Jim, you're too sane and too healthy. Your faith is too healthy to be able to imagine how people can get into this. But I'm afraid an awful lot of people today are awfully sick. And therefore this is as natural as falling off a cliff.
Is it correct to say that the modernists are sort of Catholic Kantians?
Are Catholic Kantians, yes. Yes, or Kantian Catholics. Yes. Pius X said, Kantism is the modern heresy. So, the second example is that the philosopher says that representations of the faith are merely symbolical. This, Jesus God, is simply a representation of my lovely feeling. These representations are God. Jesus God, Jesus is God. Therefore, God is a symbol. God is merely symbolical. Right? My projection of God is simply a symbol of what I have inside me. But these representations are God. God is nothing other than my representations, and therefore God is simply a symbol. God is simply an expression of what I have inside me once more. What I have inside me, my beautiful feelings, are God. God is my beautiful feelings. Right? Thirdly, Christians can, 20, so that we've got the principle of theological inwardness, the principle of theological symbolism. All of the Catholic faith is simply some kind of symbol to express my nice feelings. And then thirdly, divine permanence. Christians continue the life of Christ. Now the believer says that Christ is divine, therefore the divine continues through Christians. The Christians continue Christ. Christ is divine, therefore Christians continue the divine. If Christians continue the divine, then God continues through us Christians, and we Christians are God. QED. Quoderat demonstrandum. So, we are the continuation of God. God continues thanks to us. If we all dropped out of existence, that would be the end of God. We are the continuation of God. God continues thanks to us.
Don't the Mormons believe in it? Isn't that a Mormon?
The Mormons? Oh, very possibly.
Mormons believe all kinds of crazy things.
I think they believe that we evolve somehow into a God.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
The Catholics believe, of course, that if every single human being was wiped out of existence, God would still exist.
If the whole created universe collapsed into nothingness, which could happen, God would still exist. God is eternal and absolutely unchangeable and totally immortal. There's no way in which the existence of God in no way depends upon any creature or any combination of creatures. That's what Catholics know. Don't think they know. But
I can't believe that somebody would believe this.
You're back to the same
thing. I know you're too sane. You're too sane.
I know, but this is impossible.
Don't
explain in terms like this, it looks impossible, but yes. We're all surrounded by it. And
yes.
You know, I don't know how you safeguard yourself from getting sucked into that mush when you have to work with people who are mush.
Yes.
That's a trap.
Yes,
I mean, we're all in this nice yellow room, and we've all gotten some doctrine this week, and it's really easy to sit here and say, but when you get back out in the real world, it's not always so easy to
absorb
out the mush.
Absolutely.
I don't even think the Protestants, I don't believe this.
Give it a whirl. Give it a whirl. But the Protestants are not full-blooded modernists. Modernists goes one stage beyond the Protestants.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this is the logical conclusion, and Kant is in the Protestant tradition.
And all of this is implicit in Luther. The scorn of reason and everything else, all of this is actually wrapped up inside Luther, like the oak is wrapped up inside the acorn. Luther was a bombshell, a real bombshell. And the explosion took place in 1517, but it's still going on ever since. So, what then are dogmas? 21. Dogmas are the living elaboration of the primitive formulae according as the living community needs. So the buzzwords, living, need, experience. The dogma, Jesus is God, originally expressed my nice feeling about Jesus, God. And the community goes on feeling about that. And so we get Jesus defined as one nature, two natures, one person, according as the community needs. The community needs God of God, light of light, true God of true God. I mean, when I stood in front of Jesus and said, Jesus, I didn't think God of God, light of light, true God of true God. But the community a few years down the pike did need that. Maybe there was a few eclipses and those, so they said light of light because they were afraid of the darkness. You know, so according to their need, they evolved extra definitions to build up and express their nice feelings about Jesus. So, another thing is, obviously, I'm caricaturing this. I mean, I'm making an absolute monkey of it, which makes it sound absurd. But you talk to somebody who's into this. Oh boy, it sounds good. It's glossy. And it's got a tremendous appeal. It looks beautiful and serious and Catholic. And inside, I can do as I like. I can change the dogmas like that. I can change the commandments. I can change the dogmas. What do you feel about adultery this week? Oh, terrible. What did you feel about it last week? Well, I rather enjoyed it. Etc. 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 What do you feel about it? Right? What do you feel? What do you feel about the Ten Commandments?
These people actually really believe that they're in.
They're into this. They're into this.
I mean, of course they are. It's not something like you sit here talking about. It's
yes.
They're so deeply imbued.
Surely.
That to them.
Hey.
You're a wacko.
Yes. Yes. Oh, absolutely. Of course we are wacko as far as they're concerned. But look at charismatics. Talk to charismatics. Charismatics is this. I don't think we've got one here. I don't know of one here.
I have one.
Yeah. I think one or two have been done.
This explains why there's no sin now also.
Yes, of course. Of course. Of course there's no sin. Because if you tell me that I'm committing a sin, I'm not feeling good about it. You're stopping me from feeling good about myself. Now I'm going to feel good about myself, so I don't commit any sins. Right? That's very appealing.
It isn't God who's offended, we're offended.
Sorry?
It isn't God who's offended, we're offended.
Yeah, that's right. You got it. You got that right. But if we're offended, that means that God is offended, because we are God.
Well, that's true. I heard a charismatic preacher alleged that this very morning he had spoken in tongues, and then somebody told him, well, do you speak French? He says, I don't know. Maybe I do, maybe I don't.
Yeah? It's insane. What then, so the dogmas are simply the living elaboration of the primitive formulae. Jesus is God is an example of the primitive formula. And God of God, light of light, true God of God is the elaboration of the primitive formula according as the community needs. According as the living community needs, because dogmas must evolve according with life, otherwise they become dead. What then are the sacraments? The sacraments, for instance, the water of baptism, the host and the chalice. What are the sacraments? The sacraments are products of the need that men have to have some sense expression of what's going on inside them. Now, I go to church, to Jesus' church, and I feel good about Jesus being God. But I want to see and feel Jesus being God coming into me. So I like the idea of that little white thing, that's him. And then he comes into me. Oh, what I feel. Oh. Oh, Father, when you gave me communion this morning. Oh. Oof. So, the sacraments are the products of the need of some sense expression for my religious sense. I feel good about Jesus, but there's no Galilean there, and the Sacred Heart statue isn't enough. I need him to come into me. And that's communion. So the sacraments are simply the product of a need.
But a faithful, uneducated Catholic 20, 30 years ago could feel a sense of ecstasy in receiving communion from me.
Oh, yes. Yes, of course. But again, it's completely objective. I mean, if I was a Catholic and I had a very nice internal feeling about receiving communion at some particular point, okay? And that's, of course, I'm already making fun when I say a nice internal feeling. But firstly, I know that whether or not I have nice internal feelings, this is the real presence, right? It's objective, independently of my feelings. Sometimes when I receive communion, I'm as dead as a doornail. But I still receive communion because this is still God, independently of what I feel. Right? It's got nothing to do with what I feel. Then sometimes, or I go to confession, and I'm expecting to come out on cloud nine, and I feel come out feeling like a dirty rag, but by my faith, I know that the confession operates whatever I feel like. My feelings have basically nothing to do with it. Occasionally, of course, God, to encourage me to go to confession, makes me feel good coming out, but that's his business, not mine. A Catholic says, right? It's incidental. Occasionally when I receive communion, the Lord God gives me a spiritual high, but that's his business, not mine. I know that independently of what I feel, the objective truth is still there, right? Totally different. But it's interesting you comment that because each time there's a grain of truth in these propositions of the modernists. For instance, God gave us sacraments precisely in order to put before us in material and accessible form, his goodness. For instance, when this is the principle behind the Catholic sacraments. I will wipe out the... This is the principle behind the Catholic sacraments. When Adam and Eve fell, here was the Lord God, if I may so represent him. And here was the tree with an apple. That's an apple hanging on a tree. Here's Eve. Actually, she wasn't at that point dressed in a skirt, but still. There's Eve. Okay? That's meant to be a skirt. Well, that represents that it's Eve. She turned away from God and grabbed the apple. She turned away from God and grabbed the apple. So she turned from God and turned to the creature. So what does God do in order to get us back to him? He puts under us a little host, IHS, and then Eve, when she's a good girl, she's on her knees in the church. And so she, if she goes for the sensible thing takes her back to God. Right? So that it's true that the principle behind the sacraments, the Catholic principle, the principle of our Lord behind the sacraments is indeed the putting of something material before us to help us to go back to him. Because ever since original sin, we are too concentrating on material things, so God in his mercy puts himself under material things, so that if we go for the material things, they will lift us back to God. So when this, but again, that is entirely objective. It's God who instituted the sacraments, it's God who puts himself into, or his grace into the sacraments. And therefore, if we go to the sacraments, God is there and lifts us to him. It's objective. But for the modernists, it's completely subjective. For the modernists, the sacrament is nothing except what I project upon it.
From there it becomes symbolic, and from there it becomes just a view.
Yes. Yeah. So there's a grain of truth when the modernists say that the sacraments are there to help our senses. There's a grain of truth in it. But there is completely subjective, whereas the Catholic is basically and radically objective. Totally different. Let's break there, and we'll pick up again. I hope you're getting the idea. I think you're getting the idea. And, we may be able to finish or see most of the rest. A lot of it is, from now on, it should be fairly easy sailing. I think you've now got the main ideas, and it's all completely coherent. Given the insane principle, the rest just follows.